You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet, here in my individual capacity entirely. Thank you for tuning in. We're continuing our series on the national security issues that we're facing because of the rapid development of AI. We're also needing increasing battery technology, and on the horizon is something called quantum computing, which is going to need even more energy. We're also facing changes in the way that we engage in conflict. If you haven't been watching the war in the Middle East and noticed the amount of drones that are being deployed in lieu of troops on the ground. And energy is one of the largest issues we're facing in the world of national security right now. And it certainly is inextricably intertwined with the American economy, which gives us, of course, our tax base, our quality of life, and it sustains our national security and global military primacy. But the sources of energy we need and the means of processing and refining those sources are mostly outside of our territorial borders. And they're often in countries that are hostile to our interests, including Russia and China. As you heard in our podcasts, both of them on nuclear, we still get enriched uranium from Russia. And there are also an array of other countries that have human rights records and government corruption levels that would make a mobster blush. But the energy that we need to fuel this development of AI tech depends, of course, on running, functioning data centers, and they require an incredible and growing amount of energy to sustain. What has happened is this has rendered us dependent on other nations, and we generally don't like to be in that situation. So we're really not in a position at this moment in our history to store as much energy as we would need to operate all of the systems that we rely on for our national defense. We also know that we are at a point right now with battery technology where we can recharge, but we can't really reuse batteries as easily as we would like. And to recharge them, we have to rely on fossil fuels and things often outside of wherever that battery is. The other thing that we desperately need in all instances is magnets of all things. And many of our industrial and defense items require rare minerals in order to make these magnets that they don't exist in abundance or in some cases at all within our territorial borders. And much of that stuff doesn't even exist in the borders of our closest allies. One of those minerals, in fact, exists only under the ground in China. Now, you may have noticed that in the course of trying to work out a trade deal with China, there was a holdup. We were seeking a guarantee. And in case you've been enjoying your summer, that guarantee, if you missed it, was we wanted China to promise to continue to export rare earth minerals to the United States. So you see where I'm going. These, of course, are the magnets that we need for cars and fighter jets. And without those minerals, of course, our economy flags. And I'll give you a recent example. Ford Motor Company had to stop production of EVs in May at its Chicago plant because of a magnet shortage, which was the direct result of a lack of those minerals, the minerals from China. So if we want to keep our global primacy and dominance, are we actually playing a short game while China takes advantage? While some political leaders tout a drill, baby, drill policy, and maybe we do have to do that right now, China seems to be looking way down the road. China's Xiaomi EV company sold 200,000 vehicles in 3 minutes last week. This is happening at the same time the United States is reducing or eliminating many legal incentives to promote electric vehicles. And in our car-dependent culture, where EV charging stations are still few and far between and Americans are gripped with range anxiety, we also learned that China might have figured out a fix, and we're not on that yet. Specifically, Chinese company CATL has developed a new battery and business model that makes a lot of sense when you think about it. It swaps out EV batteries that are spent for freshly charged ones. And they do this at stations you pull up to just like a gas station. So we've also talked a lot about the continent of Africa, where a lot of these minerals are, where China is also rapidly building internal infrastructure and where oil and gas has been found. And you might remember on these ports, many of them can be easily converted to military use. They're just not out of the goodness of their heart necessarily. Now, in Ethiopia, it went from a country with 6.7 motor vehicles per 1,000 people in 2016, and where used cars make up 85% of the vehicles on the road, to banning the import of combustion engine vehicles. Now Ethiopia has 100,000 EVs, so 8.3% of its estimated 1.2 million registered vehicles, and it's rapidly becoming the fastest global adopter of EVs. And this spells, of course, a new market for China. We need to talk a little bit more about what these laws are, what these international agreements are, how do things work, and which of these two dominant agencies, which is the Department of State and, of course, the Department of the Treasury, both part of the executive branch, what their role is in sort of working all of this out, because it's not a small thing. And then the second question, of course, or the bigger question, is then how do we deal with these international organizations? What is the legal structure there in terms of G20 and G7? And how do they fit into our trade strategy, if really they do anymore? So who better to ask about this, energy and international agreements, than Brian Egan, who is the former State Department legal advisor, counsel for the U.S. Department of Treasury, and the former White House counsel and more. He's just his resume. That's all. We could just do that for an hour. Let's just stop. We'll just go over his resume. Are we done? But he's now a partner at Skadden Arps. So they're very lucky to have him. And of course, he's a member of the standing committee. Brian, thanks for coming back.
My pleasure. I'm not sure we can deliver any answers on those problems. So that's quite a list.
Yeah. I've been watching this for months and thinking about, you know, where we are right now. But let's talk about, so who takes the lead? You know, you always want somebody in the government to have the lead on these things in theory. Who does that?
I'll start, because this is a legal podcast, with a typical lawyer's answer, which is it depends. Let's take one of the issues that you identified, which is the need for critical minerals. Let's take the case of enriched uranium, which the U.S. does not have the capacity to create the amount of enriched uranium that we need for our existing and growing civil nuclear facilities here in the U.S. Where do we get enriched uranium? As you said, Russia is one of the key sources for us. It's been true for decades, but there are many restrictions in place with respect to Russia. I'll name the two key ones. First is the economic sanctions that OFAC implements, which are imposed against hundreds of government agencies, including Rosatom, the nuclear agency in Russia, many banks, making it hard to pay for enriched uranium from Russia, and many other parties. Second is our Congress last year put a law in place that actually restricts purchases of enriched uranium from Russia, subject to a waiver that the Energy Department controls. So in order for enriched uranium to be purchased from Russia, if you're a company desiring to buy such uranium, you need a waiver from the Energy Department, the Secretary of Energy, and you probably are going to need a license from OFAC at the Treasury Department, the Office of Foreign Assets Control. This is an area where policy plays a big role, right? The U.S. government, I think, has a policy interest in ensuring that we have an adequate supply of enriched uranium. And so this is an area that if you're a company needing a license from OFAC, you probably will get one. If you need a waiver from Energy, you probably will get one. It's an interesting interaction between the legal framework we've set up and the policy needs of our country.
I mean, actually, it sounds terrible because in a way, if we have to depend on a country like Russia, which are bullies of the world right now, that puts us in a really terrible position. And I would imagine the same thing with China, though, you know, they haven't done anything in the last year or so. I think that would be particularly inflammatory, like the invasion of Ukraine and Russia. We hear a lot about the U.S. trade rep, though, and I wonder what, if any, role a U.S. trade rep plays and coordinating with other agencies. Is there like a referee? Do they have a phone tree? Is there a priority paper, scissors, rock to get to see who's boss that week? How does this actually work?
This is something that really changes a lot from administration to administration. Certainly, it's changed a lot in this administration, where you have different parts of the administration who kind of take on different leads for different pieces of the president's foreign policy and national security agenda. So you think about Trump 1.0, where tariffs on China were really one of the key drivers of U.S. foreign policy and national security. The U.S. trade representative in the first Trump administration was the key China actor, I'd say, for the entire administration. He kind of drove economic policy. Here in Trump 2.0, we're already seeing Trump try to take a different approach, I would say. And this is in part because of the issues you mentioned, Elisa, where we need access to materials that China really controls. And so last week you saw the Treasury Secretary, the Commerce Secretary saying, we've cut a deal with China where we are going to have access to rare earth minerals and magnets in exchange for something. Now, the something isn't really clear to me, at least. China has said something to the effect of the U.S. has agreed to roll back some of its recent restrictions. The assumption is we are going to roll back some of our export control restrictions, but we don't really know yet. So at the highest level of policy, though, we see both Commerce and Treasury playing a key role in negotiating at least the high level terms. I think below that, though, this is always true. You've got somebody who's actually doing the grunt work to figure out what the heck we've actually agreed to and how it's going to work in practice. And that's really where you have lawyers, be it them at Commerce, Treasury, the State Department, elsewhere, who are negotiating the nuts and bolts of what an agreement will look like. How will the agreement be implemented on the U.S. side? If it's the Commerce Department, it's going to be the Bureau of Industry and Security actually changing their regulations. It's pretty complicated to do these things. And that tends to be where you have lawyers getting involved to make sure the regulations that we're changing in many cases match the agreement that's been reached on the policy level.
Of course, that begs the question, what did we agree to give China? And to the extent that it's sometimes a lawyer who actually figures this stuff out. I mean, I think it's often the case, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that people who are in the negotiating level are very, very sure that something has worked out to a particular term. And then the lawyers look at it and they say, you know, no, they haven't actually agreed to that. And we haven't agreed to that. And so, I mean, on that way, it's complex for the lawyers, but they are necessary. They're also a little bit like royal tasters. You don't always want to be the person delivering the bad news, right?
Yeah, exactly. I remember being at the National Security Council under President Obama, where the leadership of the administration would say, we've just come to this agreement, and now we just need the agencies to implement it. And the lawyers that I would work with would kind of get a little bit of sweat around their collar and start grumbling a little bit. And we're not sure we can do this. We're not sure the president has the authority. How are we going to implement this? And you're right. It's the royal tasters. You're necessary, but they're kind of the realists in the room in a lot of these discussions.
I know. But I think as a president, you know, if I were up there trying to make all this stuff work and also trying to jigger the economy and keep everything moving, that I think I would find attorneys a little contemplative. I'm trying to put myself in the position of a hard driving executive that wants results, particularly when, you know, you're in a particular political party and midterms, you're staring down the barrel of midterms and you've got to have something to deliver. I think that's a dicey role, but it's a very important role. Really, it can't be done without them.
And I think that it's true in government and in private practice, private sector, that the best policymakers, the best executives, the best leaders of organizations really understand how to harness the power and the strength that being on the side of law brings to a negotiation. Lawyers like to be in the room often and early. You know, some clients like it that way. Some clients like to at least them to be around the room. Having that kind of sense of presence and frankly, security that you're going to be able to work through legal issues can be very empowering in these types of negotiations.
Yeah. And I mean, the great thing for the president is he's not paying by the hour, right?
This is true.
So there's no reason to keep the lawyers out of the room. Now, it would be a different thing if he was going to get presented with that bill, right?
Right, right.
At the end. So I'm just saying that to the president, you know, enjoy those lawyers. They're there for you and they're not billing you by the hour. And you know how bad that is. You've experienced that. You mentioned the license for Russia. We've also got the issue of copper smelting in China. I mean, whenever you say China, it's just like this big undulating, there's just a lot there. I mean, one of the issues with China, is it that everything is state-owned, right? All industry is on some level state-owned or state-controlled or state-directed. Does this play a role at all in obtaining articles from a country like, and it doesn't have to be specifically China, but sure. I mean, there are parts of the Chinese government that are sanctioned.
Yeah, I think when you're thinking about something like natural resources, those are often resources that are actually controlled by the state ultimately. It's certainly true in China. It's also true in many other parts of the world. Even in the U.S., the export of certain, you know, oil and gas from the U.S. is controlled by the U.S. government. You need a license or a waiver to export those types of products from the U.S. So often, even if the government doesn't own the asset or own the company that is creating the asset or developing the mineral, the government has a lot of say in where those products go, which leads to, you know, if you're a private company, you may need to seek a license from another government or authorization. Often, though, you're going to need the backing of your own government to do that, because often the country A's the decision as to whether to allow an export of a critical mineral will be tied to something that you as a private company can't do. It's something that your government can do. That's why there's so many state-to-state negotiations that have been true historically and certainly are true today around minerals, around other critical products that are important for, you know, our economic development and national security in the United States.
And I think, you begin to understand why companies that have the capacity to do things like build mining infrastructure, which is hugely capital and resource intensive, and you've got to have the capacity for the logistics, you know, go dredge somewhere in Africa is just incredible. I can understand why these companies would have big law firms on retainer that have armies of people, each of them with areas of expertise, because there's so much involved here, not even to get to the international tax implications and probably some additional domestic tax implications. But let's talk about the situation where we need minerals from any country. And we keep using China as an example. Let's say it's not a sanctioned company, but it's hostile. And we know they're hostile to our interests, even if that's not something that the public is generally aware of, because there are countries like this and people inside the Beltway know which countries they are. And then how does that dance work? Because you're not dealing with a sanctions regime as such. And how do these poor companies know, like, there's going to be a problem here? Like, there are going to be roadblocks set up that I have to navigate.
So the U.S. government plays a role in many of these discussions, even where there's not a sanctioned party involved. There's a branch of the Commerce Department that is in charge of commercial advocacy on behalf of U.S. and U.S. companies. The State Department out in the field plays this role as well, where our government will actually engage with other governments to say, hey, you know, we really need you. It would be in our national interest, and we think in our collective interest, if you allowed our industry to purchase some products or materials from you. So sometimes it's just a nudge from the U.S. government through these kind of policy advocacy channels. Sometimes it can be more than that, though. You take the example, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, right? A really fascinating case where you have two extremely wealthy Americans who have already expressed a willingness, Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates, to do something to invest in the lithium mines in the Congo. They've been talking about this for the last few months. DRC response has been, look, that's great, but instead of just extracting resources, we would like something in return. And this is another area where the Trump administration announced that they had struck a deal where Congo and Rwanda have agreed to a peace, which would be fantastic for the region if it holds. We, the U.S. government, has been involved. But in exchange, there have been some kind of high-level statements made about potential U.S. partnership and investments in the region, which I think everybody is reading as something about the lithium mines and developing the mines and potentially purchasing minerals from those mines. So it's difficult to, as a private company, to steer clear of government involvement. And that's not even talking about things like compliance with U.S. law, right? The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Making sure you're not violating that law is something that's going to be high on your checklist. making sure you're protecting your investment from expropriation. What happens if the political situation changes overseas? Do you have an adequate legal framework in place to protect the investment that you've made overseas? Protecting yourself from sanctions by our own government. The DRC, until very recently, itself was subject to sanctions. So what happens if the political winds change in the United States? Are you able to remove yourself without losing your shirt on an investment in a place like the Congo? And human rights considerations. Are you using child labor? Are you benefiting from things that, you know, as a policy matter and maybe as a legal matter, your company has said you would not do? So it's a complicated framework that you're entering into, even where you're not in a zone dealing with a country that's like subject to U.S. sanctions.
Yeah. And I mean, the vicissitudes in a continent like Africa, in a place like the DRC, which doesn't have one ethnic group, you know, multiple warring ethnic groups going back historically, a lot of these countries, it's just a template. Somebody just laid something down and said, this is a country toward the end of colonialism. And these people don't necessarily get along with one another. And there is a lot of up and down. There are a lot of government issues. But your point about human rights, I think, is a really important one because, I mean, no company wants reputational damage for like hiring security to protect, let's say, mining infrastructure, only to find out that, you know, this is like a terrorist group, as we would understand it, even if they're not a designated, they're thugs. And, right. You know, they're a problem, but they're also people with weapons and they're organized and they can protect the mine site. And then you mentioned another issue, which is the child labor issue, which I think sort of resonates differently on the continent than it does for us with our sort of robust child labor laws and our history of, you know, abuses in the textile mills. But you don't just need a lawyer. You need a lawyer who's moonlights in PR. That's very, very complicated. And I'm glad you mentioned the issue about Bill Gates and Bezos. I wonder, Brian, are you tracking? I mean, DOJ said, look, we're going to treat this Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, or FCPA, as we call it, a little bit differently than the last administration. A lot of people feel like that's probably fair because there are countries where it would not be against the law, for example, to pay an official. Are there sort of other things lurking out there besides FCPA, do you think, that present a risk?
I think even on FCPA, as you say, if you're a company, you hear what the current administration says about its posture about around enforcement. But then you look at the statute of limitations and you say, well, you know, 5-year statute of limitations, that could outlast the current administration. What if there's a flip in the next administration? You know, so you can't put that aside. And of course, the current administration's not saying they're saying they're going to, you know, pursue criminal enforcement where appropriate, even if they don't pursue civil enforcement. So it's not a totally clear message on that. I think that's one area where you're focused. You're also always thinking about your import restrictions, right? So forced labor, if you try to import products made from forced labor to include forced child labor, that there's a ban under U.S. law from doing that. So if your purpose is to bring things to the United States, you've got to, you know, make sure your supply chain is such that you will not get stopped at the border by CBP with shipment of goods because of forced labor concerns. You know, sanctions and export issues also come into play. If you're sending technology into a third country in order to, you know, to develop a mine, to develop a pipeline, whatever the case may be, you may be exporting something that requires licenses, exporting technology. So there's lots of U.S. legal issues that would come into play in addition to the kind of commercial negotiations that you're going to want to make sure you have your hands around when you're entering into a negotiation like that.
Let's flip this. So we're talking about expeditions by companies overseas. You know, the truth is that we have a lot of languishing infrastructure and things that are suitable to sort of turn the switch back on, start the factory like happens in the movies. But we've been watching lately. I like the idea of that, you know.
I do too. Yeah.
But one thing that I'm looking at is, you know, we have distressed U.S. steel companies. And I know most Americans and most lawyers care about this stuff because we know that that's where those fallen places are, where we have the opioid crisis. There's massive unemployment. You know, the schools are poorly funded now. We don't have to talk specifically about the Japanese investment into the U.S. steel company, but foreign investment often resuscitates these companies. So what are the legal issues there? And How do the national security lawyers get involved?
When a foreign investor wants to make an investment in a U.S. business, even a failed or failing U.S. business, there can be a national security review of that investment by an interagency group chaired by the Treasury Department called the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, or CFIUS. CFIUS is not an illness, as my wife asked me the first time she heard me mentioning it on a phone call. Some may think it's an illness, particularly some foreign investors. One of the factors that, you know, CFIUS is kind of known infamously as a black box. You don't know what CFIUS is reviewing. You don't know what criteria they're looking at. As a practitioner, I think it's more like a grayish box because you have some sense for the things that are going to matter to U.S. policymakers and U.S. national security. CFIUS tells you at least to some extent what they're interested in. And in an area where you're talking about a failed or a failing U.S. business, particularly in an industry that's important to the U.S., I think one of the points you're trying to make and advocate as a lawyer for a client is this investment is actually going to help the U.S. economy and help U.S. national security by reinstating a U.S. domestic source of a product or technology or manufacturing base that is missing. That is a real argument. That is something that the government takes very seriously. Everything from steel to solar manufacturing to things that are in short supply for the U.S. Department of Defense. They want, the U.S. government wants U.S. sources for materials, even if they are owned by foreign investors. Sometimes you need to agree to conditions in order to get CFIUS approval, conditions that may be anything from ensuring supply for the U.S. government to ensuring that a factory or facility will not be moved offshore for some period of time to other things. But that's a national security argument that one can make in order to secure approval through the CFIUS process.
So it's interesting you talk about conditions being on a deal like that. I think when Americans hear about foreign companies investing, I think one of the biggest concerns that we've had, and this spans multiple administrations, is a highly apolitical thought, but it's the loss of intellectual property that could potentially occur or a military advantage. So let's say a company produces something that can be purposed to a very high level of a defense article use in the home country of the investor. What do conditions look like? Are there things that just can't be overcome because they're just too dangerous to let out? I mean, can they disaggregate computer systems, remove, you know, separate networks? I mean, does it get down to that level of granularity to make some of these deals happen and, you know, flip the switch and get the factory running?
Sometimes it does. If there's a concern about the sensitivity of what a factory or facility is making, one of the conditions may be a logical separation, if you will, of IT systems between the foreign investor and the U.S. company so that there cannot be data exfiltration. In the most extreme cases, there may literally be what's known as a proxy set up in the United States. So the U.S. subsidiary will have its own board of directors. It will have its own security policies. The foreign investor can own the U.S. company. It can make money off the U.S. company. It can have some amount of directional governance over the U.S. company, but it can't really have insight into the technologies or the government contracts or other things. And it can get very detailed. I've been on CFIUS matters where we have entered into a mitigation agreement, which is a contract between the U.S. government and the parties to a transaction, where the mitigation agreement has been over 100 pages with exhibits, with security officers in charge of implementing the mitigation agreement on nearly a full-time basis within the U.S. company. It can be very detailed. It can feel very intrusive sometimes to both parties. You know, in many cases, they're willing to take those conditions because they've decided commercially that the investment makes sense.
I think, you know, listening to you, young lawyers have to think, how can I become an expert as a new lawyer on these multifaceted trade issues that have such a big impact on our energy supply and our defense?
I think they're cool. I think you think they're cool. We wouldn't be doing what we're doing if we didn't agree with that. If you're a lawyer and you're interested in these issues, you've got to be thinking about a couple of different things. One is government service. You know, I think government service, which has traditionally been an apolitical job, is where you really get to grapple with a lot of the biggest policy issues or implement them in a way that you can't do from outside. And really having a seat inside is irreplaceable in my mind. If you're interested in these issues, if you're patriotic, if you're willing to work long hours, it's funny. The joke is always, oh, government's a 9-to-5 job. That's why people do it. You and I would agree that that is certainly not the case.
Absolutely not.
You got to be willing to put the time in. You got to be willing to make less money than your peers in private practice. But there can be real rewards in getting involved in these issues. And then I'd say on the private side, don't limit yourself. You know, law firms do this work like my law firm, but a lot of companies struggle with these things. A lot of nonprofits struggle with these issues. A lot of nonprofits advocate about these issues. Colleges and universities have to deal with these issues. So don't be imaginative in thinking about where these issues may come up. And then the final thing I'd say is just kind of follow your gut. As a young lawyer, you shouldn't know where you're going to go when you graduate law school. You're going to find opportunities along the way. Don't be afraid to take them because it's hard to know where these steps will lead you.
Yeah, ride the wave. Well, that's great advice. I hope that our younger listeners appreciate that.
I hope that our younger listeners will appreciate my advice more than my younger children do, at least, who don't always appreciate my advice. So thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Yeah, that's great. And thank you for coming in, Brian. It's always a pleasure to have you on. And I want to thank everybody for tuning into NSLT tonight. Now, many of you have been watching the discussion of mining the deep seabed, to get minerals. We did a 6-part series on this years ago. Everything that we discussed in that series remains true today. We will hyperlink at least the first in those episodes. We cover everything. We even in that series discussed the risk to subsea cables on which we depend for our international communications. And they exist on the floor of the seabed and right there in the Clarion-Clipperton zone where they're talking about scraping. And as it's been explained to me, these things are no bigger than a garden hose. So we'll hyperlink that. But because this is unfolding in real time right now, it might be beneficial for those of you interested in energy as a national security discussion to hear some of what we covered during that series. And by the way, please be sure to subscribe to NSLT. Give us a rating on your listening app of choice if you like us. Make sure you share this podcast with your friends who might be interested in energy and national security. And remember, we're committed to keeping this cost-free, intelligent, long-form content so that you can feel enriched. And remember, try to hear each other right now. There's a lot of noise and a lot of yelling on social media and on other media. And it's very important to listen to one another's point of view and not respond immediately. Trust me, you will become a better lawyer if you can develop that as a habit. So thanks for listening. We'll be back with more energy next week. Our writer, producer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet. I am always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is the indefatigable Holly McMahon, along with all the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. We'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.